Welcome, and we're going to work on our session tonight, Jesus and the Restoration of Manna Society. I realize when we finish today that we still have a ways to go in what's called the Hebrew Bible, and I found that from some Jewish friends and in Jewish Christian dialogue, the sensitivity to our Jewish brothers and sisters in saying Hebrew Bible instead of Old Testament. Old Testament sounds like it's old and worn out. You ever thought of that? And to say Hebrew Bible and New Testament is more sensitive. So I try to do that and I forget. I want to continue with some of the passages from the Old Testament prophets as they cried out against the kind of Egypt society that had been developed in the Northern Kingdom and the Southern Kingdom. And I'll read these as kind of our opening thoughts. Isaiah 10, woe to those who enact unjust decrees, who compose oppressive legislation to deny justice to the weak, to cheat the humblest of my people of fair judgment, to make widows their prey and to rob the orphan. What will you do on the day of punishment when disaster comes from far away? And then from Isaiah 5. Woe to those who add house to house and join field to field until there is nowhere left and they are the sole inhabitants of the country. Yahweh Sabaoth has sworn this in my hearing. Many houses will be brought to ruin, great and fine ones left untenanted. For 10 acres of vineyard will yield only one barrel. 10 bushel of seed will yield only one bushel. And then from Micah 2, 1 through 2, that really cries out against the land grabbing. Micah 2, disaster for those who plot evil, who lie in bed planning mischief. That picture of going to bed at night in those minutes before you go to sleep, just planning whom you can exploit tomorrow. No sooner is it dawn than they do it. They can't wait to get up in the morning, since they have the power to do so. Seizing the fields that they covet, they take over houses as well. Owner and house they seize alike, the man himself as well as his inheritance. Notice it never says his property. It's always the consciousness you don't own anything. It's always called one's inheritance from God. And then again, the words of the disaster that is coming. I have a diagram that's helped me to understand manna and what happens. And the society is set up like this, that God gives and gives and give. And then the lines here represent the manna that God pours out upon the earth in abundance. And the healthy shalom society, these are arms of people who tied together in community. People, you get it? people tied together in community, and the response to the gift of God is worship. And the worship of Israel was many things, but at least twofold. It was a giving back of thanksgiving. And then it was a worship of memory. The worship life of Israel was to reincorporate oneself in the memory of the past gifts of God, especially the liberation from Egypt that made us the people we are. So the worship life was always a reincorporation into the identity of the community of freed slaves. And then the community then stood together as partners. No king except Yahweh God, Yahweh Sabaoth. And then there was a twofold understanding that held the community together, and that was the understanding to live in righteousness and mercy. And Paul D. Hansen, in his lectures here at Holden, if you listen to the tapes, and also his book, People Called, makes much of this twofold. That if somehow this was all going to be held together, it was kind of the triad of worship and the life of righteousness and the life of mercy. The righteousness was the keeping of the covenant gift. The keeping of the covenant law was the life of righteousness. But that was not enough. That would eventually move into a type of legalism that would lose all feeling. So that was always balanced in the community with mercy. And mercy was a tender compassion for especially the most vulnerable. And that was mainly in the Bible is the widow, the orphan, and the sojourner. These are the people whose life was on the edge of not having enough food. These are the people who were on the edge of being taken advantage of, becoming slaves. And so the life of the community was a balance of keeping the covenant rule and balancing it with a deep sense of mercy and tender compassion. Now, I want to draw what happened with the... I thought of something that I had left out today in this whole scheme. And now, maybe I just didn't say it enough. But in this understanding that God owns all and God gives to all and that we own nothing, is there any place in this scheme of things for what we normally call charity? Giving something to the poor. Does that even exist? Why? I see you shaking your head.
Well, because it can't be charity, it isn't ours to give in the first place.
First, you own nothing, so how can you possibly give anything to the poor? And there is no place whatsoever for any understanding that I have been good by giving part of my property to the poor, or part of my possessions to the poor, because I don't own any possession. We're even misled a little by the way the word, by the translation in the New Testament of give. The English word give, we tend to think that means I own something and then I have the power and the authority and the goodness to give it away, to give to somebody else. And the Greek meaning of the word give in the New Testament that ties it to manna spirituality is release. And when you see the word give in the New Testament, it means God's manna flows to everyone and every living thing, and it flows to me sufficiency, and anything that gets stuck onto me that's going to start becoming a pile, that becomes enslaving, and then it becomes the wonderful free act of simply releasing that and letting it flow on. And so the understanding in manna spirituality is, and this is a hard one for us with all of our stocks, bonds, savings accounts, bank accounts, saving it up, is that anything that gets stuck on me that I don't need, or on our family that we don't need beyond our sufficiency, is God's manna for someone else, and then it's the joy then of releasing it, so it's no longer bogging down my life. Backpacking is a wonderful way to understand this. You know, when you're backpacking, too much stuff is slavery. Do you know what I mean? And there's something freeing about releasing it. Do you know what I mean? You're backpacking. Do you know what I mean? There's something freeing and liberating to release it. And manna spirituality really calls life as a journey. It's a journey hand in hand with the whole community and the whole world through time. And to get that pile of stuff, it's like backpacking and your pack is too heavy. And therefore it becomes a gospel kind of liberation. No, I've an example of these two types of mentality. One is our common thought of charity, and the other is manna. It's two feeding programs for the poor and the homeless and street people. One was in a church in San Diego that this has changed since, and I think things are going better. But they have a feeding program called Bread Day, and it's a wonderful program where really hundreds of street people once a week go to First Lutheran Church in San Diego and receive bread, and the bread has now turned into bread and soup, and the bread and soup has turned into bread, soup, and salad. A joyful program, but there's one woman that just didn't get it. And many of the people that come through speak only Spanish, and she would look at them as they came in to make sure they understood that they should be grateful. You know, then they would always do some little thing wrong, so she'd yell at them to make them feel dumb, and then resentfully give them the food. And my dear mother says this woman has changed now. Somebody, maybe there was a metanoia, perestroika. Which reminds me, when we were in the Soviet Union this summer, we were told that in the Russian Bible, the word repentance is perestroika. That'd be interesting, the theology of Gorbachev. Repentance is the word perestroika. Well, now we're... Oh, the other I saw on television was kind of the end of the news one night, where they showed a feeding program in New York, some Roman Catholic sisters, and it was a restaurant owner that the excess food every night brought to this feeding program. And they just showed, and they didn't mean, but the voices came across, and the Roman Catholic sisters were just smiling at all the people as they came by. And I listened carefully to hear what they were saying to each person. And to each person they said, "Thanks for coming." Now the spirituality behind that is that God has given us too much manna, and we are in danger of a pile. And your coming here is making it so much easier for our releasing. We don't have to go out and find you. Thanks for coming. You see, the whole turned around mentality. Now when this gets disrupted, I want to just draw a picture of what happens. Here's all the people. First, your worship becomes boring because it no longer fits into the new life you've kind of built for yourself. So you go through the motions without a sense of thanksgiving and memory. You cross those out. You cross this out, and then you cross this out. And then some people become big deals and little deals, so you cross this out. God continues to give and give and give. But then this person grows in importance and then builds what we call a system. And the system I like to think of as a human-built funnel. You know, that's catching all the manna. You get it so far? And then the person has pushed everybody over to here. And then that's a mouth and that's a nose. Poor guy. Okay, then you are now obviously separated from these people, but so a wall needs to be built, and probably a few weapons on the wall, just in case. But then what you also build in into this system is something to kind of help your guilt a little, if you have any. And it's a little pipeline here with a few drops of manna coming out here. And then a faucet, but you make sure that is on your side of the wall so you are in control of that. And now this is Israel and Judah at the time of the prophets. Nothing contemporary. It's only what they did back there. And then, what's that?
Trickle down.
Yeah, this is your it's your trickle theory. Some of it is going to trickle. And the more manna that comes in here, then the idea is the more drops, you know, that will go up here. But the Dorothy Zole, now you can help me say this one.
Sole.
Yeah. She gave a wonderful speech in Vancouver, British Columbia, at the World Council of Churches. I have it with me if anybody would like to read it tomorrow, her speech. But she talks about the bondage on both sides of the wall, the oppression on both sides of the wall. On this side, it's a very obvious oppression of just not having enough food. That's what we're going to meet today in our Bible story, just not having enough. Starvation, sickness, the hunger, the disease that results. And then on this side is the spiritual sickness and the spiritual hunger of being disconnected from nature, disconnected from the world, and finally disconnected from God, the Creator and the Giver of all, that leads to the spiritual hunger of seeking salvation in things that never give salvation. In our lesson tonight, Jesus, the bread of life, trying to find bread and hunger or satisfaction for hunger and that which does not satisfy. And in her beautiful speech, she just showed with great compassion the hunger on both sides of the wall and how the gospel then is liberation for both sides. Now situation as we meet as the prophets cry out against the people and the systems now they have built for their own advantage. Now, during this time of crisis, the last years before going into captivity, it was also a time when the prophets dreamed wondrous dreams. There's something so very beautiful about this, that it was a time of the greatest discouragement when the prophets were dreaming the most wondrous visions of God's wonderful future. Let me read Micah 4, 1 through 4. Now, this is one thing to say this when everything's going well and you're having a fairly happy day and you sit down and say, I'm going to write something happy. That's one thing, but when everything in the society is falling apart and the rot and the maggots have taken over, then out comes this word of hope. But in the days to come, Yahweh's temple mountain will tower above the mountains, will rise higher than the hills. Then the peoples will stream to it. Many nations will come and say, Come, we will go up to Yahweh's mountain, to the temple of the God of Jacob, so that God may teach us God's ways, and we may walk in Yahweh's paths. For the law issues from Zion, Yahweh's word from Jerusalem. And then it's Yahweh who will judge between the nations, and then they will hammer their swords into plowshares, their spears into pruning hooks. A nation will not lift a sword against nation or ever be trained to make war, but each person will sit under their fig and their vine, and no one will trouble them. The mouth of Yahweh Sabaoth has spoken. You can go on and read these visions and dreams at these deplorable times of all of the animals living together in peace, about the child playing with the snakes, and the lion and the cattle living together in peace, and the promise that this day will come. And the other, another wonderful dream that came out of this period was an answer to a very difficult question that Jesus would get, but most people wouldn't. And how will this day of shalom come to this earth? How will this day come? Who will bring it? And what will it take for this day to come? Isaiah 42. Here is my servant whom I uphold, my chosen one in whom my soul delights. I have sent my spirit upon him, and he will bring justice to the nations. Now, how does this bringer of justice, righteousness, and mercy come? What power does this person use? He does not cry out or raise his voice. His voice is not heard in the street. He does not even break the crushed reed or snuff the faltering wick. Faithfully he presents fair judgment, and he will not grow faint, he will not be crushed, until he has established fair judgment in all the earth. And this vision now that takes place during the Babylonian captivity, that this day of peace will come to this earth, but it will come through the innocent suffering of the servant of Yahweh. Now, if we had a whole session now and have to move on, but we just focus on the experience of exile, what was it like now for these people who had lived and their society had rotted and been crushed by the Babylonians? Imagine what it was like to go into Babylonian exile. Torn from your home, torn from your family. Closest sense I have is one a student at PLU, Kauna, one of the Namibian students at PLU, who has not been home for 10 years, because he had to flee Namibia, and has been in exile. And it means being torn from family, torn from everything familiar. And for those people, it was torn from the temple, torn from land, families torn apart, and going off in chains into the exile in Babylon. But then the words of God that come to them in that captivity, and you can almost feel the hope that builds up in the heart of God. This is Egypt again, and I'm going to call the people out of Egypt. I'm going to do it again. And every hill will be lifted up, or brought low, every valley will be lifted up. And the righteous of the Lord will return and come to Zion with shouting and great joy. And then the dream of all of those with weaknesses, the lame will walk, and the blind will see, And in the desert, the flowers will sprout, and they'll become lush fields, and it'll be a new day as the people go out of the new Egypt. And it happened in the year 539, and it was under Cyrus the Persian, who defeated the Babylonians. He was an emperor that had something very strange called wisdom. And he was, maybe Gorbachev had some of his characteristics, and who knows what's going to happen, but he had a way of saying that people are happiest when they have a sense of their national identity and their national autonomy. And while then Persia ruled the world, they gave relative freedom to each part. And he went to Babylon, or sent his emissaries to Babylon, to the Jewish community, and say, you can go home. It's time to go home. And imagine as the words went through the households in the Babylonian captivity. Some didn't go because they'd made it in Babylon. You know, things were going too well for them. But for many, it's time to go home. And then across the wilderness and across the desert, homecoming. And now the smile of God and the hope in the heart of God will try again. They'll try again. And their homecoming, sometimes it's called the big fizzle. Because, you know, all the dreams of the prophets of the everything just sprouting a new life. They came home to a ruined land. And they were weak and they were poor. And they came back, though, dedicated to righteousness, of keeping fervently the covenant gift. Something they had trouble getting, though, was the visions of the old prophets and the manna society of mercy to the foreigner. And the community now became more and more inclusive, more and more despising of foreigners, until they even cast out every wife, cast out of the community every wife who was not Jewish. And this, again, just like the old pro-king, anti-king argument, must have been a tremendous conflict in the community, and the suffering of throwing women out of the community because they were foreign-born. And it was into this community that God now raises up storytellers. Storytellers to teach them another way. And this is where the story of Ruth comes. Was Ruth Jewish? Anybody remember her nationality? What? Moabite. And she was the grandmother of their greatest king, David. Well, it's not bad for a start. You know, when you're throwing out foreign wives, listen to this story. Maybe you'll change your mind. And then also the story of Jonah. Where did Jonah go to preach? To Nineveh, to this wicked city of heathens and pagans. And the miracle of this city repenting and coming to God. And God is saying in the story of Jonah, I love all people. And I want you to love all people too. But this never became a popular idea. Never became popular. Now, if you remember trying to learn dates in history classes, in high school history. Now, this is one of the easiest ones is when Alexander the Great defeated the Persians and therefore established over the ancient world the Greek Empire. It was the year 333. How can you forget that one? 333. And Alexander the Great had a deep respect for Jewish religion and allowed Jewish people to continue their practices in the Greek Empire, although Alexander was a real missionary for Greek culture and Greek religion. But he was not followed by wisdom. And one of his kingdom was divided into three. Those who ruled now Palestine, the place of the Jews, they're easy to remember, Antiochus the First, Antiochus the Second, Antiochus the Third, and Antiochus the Fourth. Antiochus the Fourth has a reputation among Jewish people about equal to Adolf Hitler. And that gives you some feeling. And he was determined to wipe Jewish religion and the worship of Yahweh, the God of Abraham and Sarah, off of the face of the earth. And we cannot imagine the terror and the torture and the secret police and the bloodshed, and also the many Jewish people that adopted Greek religion at this time to save themselves. And then the preachers now, realizing they could not preach openly, developing underground stories and underground literature to keep the people, help the people remain faithful during what was called the Great Persecution. And the stories are horrendous of this time. If one example is if he felt circumcised, the priest was killed, the father was killed, and the baby was killed, and then the mother forced to walk through the land and through the streets of the town with her dead baby tied around her neck as a it's called deterrence. To keep others from being faithful to the tradition of their ancestors. Just one example of Antiochus Epiphanes was not only cruel, he was sadistic in the terror that he inflicted upon the Jewish people. And it was in that situation that the great Maccabean brothers and the Maccabean family rose up and organized, we'd call them today guerrilla, bands that gathered the people throughout the Greek rulers. And in the year 164, cleansed the temple, because I forgot to mention Antiochus IV, who called himself Epiphany, which means, of course, a manifestation of God, had built an altar to himself in the Holy of Holies in the little temple that the people had built when they came back from Babylon. They took his idol down and they restored the temple. And the story is that the candles that were not enough to burn very long burned for how many days? 8 days. And the victory and the cleansing of the temple would be dated now December 25th. And what is this Jewish celebration of Hanukkah? The cleansing of the temple. Now the people have another chance to set up a man of society, because this is the first time since the fall to Babylon that they have political independence. And there were many among the poor of the land, and already the word Anawim, the poor of Yahweh, the faithful, the righteous of Yahweh, had already become now a self-conscious, identifiable group among the people, those who are faithful to God. But now the nation was taken over by a dynasty of priests. There isn't a king anymore. So the priests now start running the state. And here's an example of what would happen when the church takes over the state, and Jerry Falwell is running things. Would be an example today of church leaders that really church people that say, if only we could run things and make this country Christian, would be an example. But the priests take over, and now rot happens again, because they vie for each other for power, and they set up their systems and they start taking over the land from the poor and build these great priestly estates. Then they break into different competing priestly families trying to take over the country, and the nation begins to rot, and the maggots come back. And when when the Roman Empire defeats the Greeks, and the Roman Empire is now spreading over the world. It was almost a bloodless. The people of Palestine, the Jewish people, simply fall into the Roman Empire like rotten fruit. And now they live under the Roman domination. And the Roman domination is the power of Rome, and Roman soldiers marching the streets, the Roman symbol set up in the cities and the towns. And the Romans made a deal with these priestly rich now that had been ruling the country before. And the Romans set up a taxation system. And I don't know if this has ever happened since, I'm being sarcastic. But it's a taxation system that favors the rich and is of a disadvantage to the poor. You know I'm being sarcastic when I say this has never happened since. But then they set up this system now then that allows both the rich, who are probably non-priestly, but many who are the priestly classes, who appear in the New Testament as the Sadducees. And it makes it possible for them to now take over the land more and more from the poor until their estates become larger and larger, and more people become either tenant farmers or many, many, and possibly the majority of the common people now become day laborers. Meaning you go to a place in the morning and hope to find daily work. And if the work isn't there, there's no food for the family. And we already now have the background of the original Aramaic wording of the Lord's Prayer, "Give us tomorrow's bread today," which in its very original was, "Oh God, give me daily work so there'd be bread tomorrow for the family." And it's really a "give us daily bread." And it became then a prayer for a little community of poor people living together in their little hovels. When they prayed, "Give us tomorrow's bread today, may enough of us work tomorrow so then they can share with the people who do not have work for today." Now, at the time when John the Baptist is ready to come on the scene, some of the mentalities are this is an intense anger of the poor people, because daily they walk by the land that was the inheritance, their manna, and they know the piece of land that was given to them as a trust by God, and now it's part of a large estate of an absentee landowner, and therefore many of them become guerrilla soldiers to do the Maccabean thing again. So there's this intense anger, and then coupled with that is an intense expectation that the promises made to David would be fulfilled, that the kingdom of David would reign forever, and a new David would appear in the form of the Messiah. And when the new David came, the new Messiah, or the Messiah, the anointed one of God, that Messiah King would make things right and would restore to the poor the land that God, that was their inheritance, and then God would restore through the Messiah a manna society. So there was anger and great expectation, and there was a whole class of people again called the Anawim, those who didn't have to work, that were old, spent their days and their nights in the temple pleading and pleading and crying to God to send the Messiah. I have this picture of the temple in Jerusalem. The priests, who were mostly of the wealthy classes, there were exceptions, but they had to step over the Anawim, there were so many of them, to try to do their priestly duties, because the Anawim were just there crying and weeping and pleading with God to do what God had done in Egypt, And they read the passages and they knew that we read from Exodus, where God heard the moaning of the slaves in Egypt, and now it's the moaning of the poor of Palestine. And it's this cry, God, do it again. God, come again. God, you redeemed our ancestors from Egypt. Come again now. We cry to you. We plead to you. And the cries and the moans day and night and day and night. Now, that is where I stop now to begin the story of Jesus and the type of world that Jesus came into. Okay, how's our time? I've been in kind of a timeless state here. I hope you're still with me. 7:15. Okay. Now, I want to raise a question about the Hebrew Bible and the New Testament, and really two models, and then just ask the question for a little discussion. Which model have we tended to follow? And should I erase this? I just love this. I just kind of gobble, 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 gobble. The only thing that, after I laugh at this a while, the hard part is to realize the struggle, you know, of in the Spirit of God caring deeply about this side of the wall, and realize that I live on this side of the wall. And how do we live as people of faith in that tension? I don't know, has anybody started to feel that? How do we live in this tension? That's for Monday. We're going to talk about that. Here are the two models. One is that the Hebrew Bible. Is about God creating a society. The Hebrew people. But the main reason we have this story of the Hebrew Bible, because God creates a society out of which, and then there's really a break between Hebrew Bible and New Testament. And then the main point of the New Testament is not the creating of a society of people, but the main point of the New Testament is Jesus dies on the cross so souls will go to heaven. Anybody heard this? Okay, then the main purpose of this creation of society, so it becomes in the people out of which Jesus comes, so then Jesus can die on the cross, so people that believe in him will not go to hell, but will go to heaven when they die. And it has very little to do with anything that the Old Testament seems to be so concerned about, and that is the building of a healthy human society. And therefore, we really have a break, and we all almost just have the two bound into two different books. So we carry them like this. And you're already kind of feeling which of these two models I'll be closer to personally. Or am I being objective? Or okay, the second is the same as the Hebrew Bible. Is God creating a society? And then I'm not even going to make a break here. The New Testament is centered in Jesus, who really restores this society. And then by his death and resurrection,
And I'm going to use the word I like, ooze. Is that how you spell ooze? By his death and resurrection, ooze. The whole world, all the nations, into this society. Now I get it. So it's one story, it's one book, it's a society that God molds through the years, and then a Jesus who comes to really reform and renew and restore the society, and then by his death and resurrection to call the entire world, all of the nations, into this society of shalom and health and righteousness and mercy and manna. Now, I'll ask the question. First, just a little story that shows how well we've communicated this one. When served in Albuquerque, we took a confirmation class to the Jewish synagogue, and I don't know if Rabbi Selnick is still there. You ever heard his name? But after the synagogue service, we had a little class with Rabbi Selnick, and we had one of these kids in confirmation that always had the brilliant question. You know, and his question was, what's the difference between Judaism and Christianity? And the rabbi answered it according to probably the way he'd been taught or observed throughout his life. He says, Judaism teaches people how to live on this earth together, and Christianity teaches people what they need to do to go to heaven when they die. Is that interesting? He was stating that. So I'm just asking the question: Have we tended towards the model that I have on the top? And if so, how has this been? Kind of this break between the what we call the Old Testament and the New Testament, almost like they're two different things.
Well, the rabbi stated the way Christianity really has put itself forth.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we taught.
Christianity has generally done a real poor job of explaining what it's all about. Mm-hmm. And the rabbi was able to state pretty objectively what a lousy job we've done of stating what Christianity is.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he had learned, you know, what we had taught him.
Yeah. I think the top model does seem to be the dominant one in our culture, is that because it so well fits into our culture, it enhances individualism.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
it suits
very well.
And defers justice. Mm-hmm. Wait for justice until sometime after you die.
Mm-hmm.
So don't agitate now.
Mm-hmm. One thing, and it was clear in the John passage that was read in Vespers, that by moving more to the second model, we don't deny that the promise of the death and resurrection of Jesus includes the promise of eternal life. That is very clear. But then to say it's only after death, then we're going to really ask the question. Now, of the New Testament, is the New Testament a book that really carries on the same theme of the Old Testament, of a shalom society and its creation here on this earth? Well, it's really the question I'm going to ask the New Testament now. You already know how I'm going to come out, so I'm for B. Anybody else want to reflect any on this? But,
Well, we probably wouldn't attract as many people into the church with the second model. So.
I mean, it wouldn't be quite as packageable, mm-hmm. Is that a word?
Well, it doesn't ask people to change, like you said, change much in the way they live.
Mm-hmm.
Mm. Maybe not as many privileged people.
Yeah. Yeah, the bottom one is what would really be good news to most of the poor of this earth. The top one is what Bonhoeffer called cheap grace, but it really works in the first world. You know, relieves guilt and it promises afterlife in spite of kind of the social conditions and society conditions that we've tolerated on this earth. Well, shall we? We'll move into the. But I just wanted to show this as kind of a background of where I'm going to be looking at the New Testament. Okay, back. Now we'll. If I can go back to story time. Is everybody okay and awake and with? Hang on. All right, this kind of middle section of the study is really to tell these stories and finish the story. And then if I'm rushing a little, and probably not that much, but I'm conscious of Monday, and I would go down the hill with a very sad feeling if we hadn't had the time to really do some talking together about what does this mean for us. So I'll continue the story now. Let's go back to this. At the time that Jesus came, just if you could feel it in the air, was this feeling both of anger and expectation. And one of the popular beliefs was this, that the great prophets that arose, Isaiah, Amos, Hosea, Jeremiah, that there would not be another one until just before the Messiah comes. Just before. And you have to know that to understand the excitement when you heard about this strange man in camel's hair out in the wilderness at the Jordan River shouting at people just like the old prophets. Because it meant the time is here. Our hope and our expectation, it's almost here. And so they go, and the New Testament even said all of Jerusalem went. Kind of last one out, turn out the lights. On their way down the hill to the wilderness and to the desert. And we're together enough on this study, I think I don't have to tell you the symbolic meaning of John didn't go to Jerusalem, but John called the people to wilderness. To rebirth, to baptism, which was a new Reed Sea event, and then to wilderness school. And then it's amazing, and I'm going to read it in Luke 3. The new wilderness school, John finds the old school desks, and he finds the old blackboard. And he sets up the school again. First he gives his sermon, which again he had studied homiletics for popularity. He said to the crowds who came, you brood of snakes. Who warned you to flee from the coming retribution? The idea when the Messiah comes, if you're not ready, it's not going to be a day of good news. It's going to be a day of burning fire. So produce fruit in keeping with repentance. And do not start telling yourselves we have Abraham as our father. I'm the proper race. I'm a proper person. I'm telling you God can raise children for Abraham from these stones, which there were probably a billion of them around. And even now the axe is laid to the root of the trees, so that any tree failing to produce fruit will be cut down and thrown into the fire. And then when all the people asked him, and this is a surprise if you're ever a preacher, this happened to me once teaching a class in a church that I evidently was unusually fervent that night, and at the end three people came up and said, then what shall we do?
And I stood there. It just isn't part of my lesson plan. Anybody to take this seriously enough to ask for. I had a wonderful discussion and we came up with some ideas. They asked John, what must we do then? And he answered, and now here's the wilderness school again. John says, anybody who has two coats, share with the one who has none. And now see the mentality that John is asking to be put into the brains of the people again. It's manna. Some had more but had not too much. Some had less but had not enough. The wilderness spirit. And anyone with something to eat will do the same. You know, if you have more than enough bread, then release it, release it. This is manna happening again. And there were tax collectors, too, who came for baptism, and they said, well, what shall we do? And he said, exact no more than the appointed rate. No. There's really no more piles. You know, life is about something else now with the coming of the Messiah. Soldiers asked him, well, what about us? What must we do? And he said, no intimidation and no extortion, and be content with your pay, which is a wilderness way of saying practice sufficiency. Now live with sufficiency, because now with the coming of the Messiah, what life is all about is something so different than what your life has been about. And that's been using your power as a soldier to get money out of people. And it's amazing now that John says, in preparing for the Messiah, we again bring the wilderness man of spirituality back. Then, when Jesus comes, and I leave so much that is important out now, the baptism of Jesus, his ordination, his baptism, his testing in the wilderness. What kind of a Messiah will he be? Will he follow the way of glory like King David, or the way of the suffering servant in Isaiah? And then Jesus goes to the synagogue and preaches his inaugural speech in Luke. And this is Luke 4, verse 18. Jesus came to Nazareth and went into the synagogue, stood up to read, then handed the scroll of the prophet Isaiah. He unrolled the scroll, and then he found the place where it is written. Jesus chose his text. See, he found the place where it was written. From Isaiah, the Spirit of the Lord is on me, for he has anointed me to bring good news to the poor, liberty to captives, sight to blind, to set the oppressed free, and to proclaim the year of God's favor. And then they thought this was a wonderful sermon. Until then he explained this was also for the Gentiles. Remember? And then the response to the sermon was trying to throw him over a cliff. And pastors want response. Right? Anything. And this was the response. But why were they so happy? Because the people in the synagogue mainly were the poor, the day laborers, the tenant farmers. The ones who were hoping the Messiah would come to make things right again. And Jesus says that now in my coming, good news comes to the poor. Now, what would good news for the poor be? The gospel for the poor.
Sufficiency.
Yeah, sufficiency. You know, we are, and they, when you read those times, the poor meant their children had not enough food. You know, they lived below the line of sufficiency, so it meant the hunger and the disease
that goes with hunger was happening in Palestine. And the dream when Jesus says this, that with Jesus coming, again, we'll have the manna life of sufficiency. Good news to the poor and liberty to captives. We're talking about a Sabbath year here. The proclamation, your debts are canceled. Sight to the blind, the Isaiah dream that when the Messiah comes, the lame will walk and the blind will see. And the oppressed will go free. You know, we can just imagine again, what does that mean, people in debtor's prison maybe? It means people may be caught in the system of oppression and day labor, or tenant farmers who have to give so much of their crops to the absentee landowner that they have not enough left to feed their families and their children. This is freedom, but then the greatest is, alas, to proclaim the year of the Lord's favor. And most scholars agree that this last phrase meant, I'm proclaiming Jubilee. Now, what was Jubilee?
All the land goes back.
You know, all the land goes back to the original owners. And, I mean, I can't even begin to imagine the excitement in the synagogue when it's happening, and then how quickly that turned when they found out this was going to be for everybody. Manna is fine, and this new society is fine, but we're going to share it with the Gentiles? But this is Jesus' inaugural speech of what his ministry is about. Notice already how different it is than what we've made Jesus. In our preaching, in the wealthy first world of comfortable people. And now we'll ask the question, well, does the whole ministry bear this out? Did Jesus fulfill his campaign promise?